Good morning. It's a joy to be together in God's house. What a blessing to be able to spend some time together in prayer with people who love God and who care about you. That's a treasure that we have that the world doesn't know what it's like. So I enjoyed that. Turning your Bibles this morning to Psalms chapter 118. I came across this psalm as I was in my one of my devotional times. I was reading it here, and I was impressed with a verse in Psalms 118 and verse 24 in chapter 118 of Psalms. And we'll be spending some time in Psalms 118, so that's why I ask you to turn there. So Psalms 118, verse 24 says, "This is the day which the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." There's a lot more in that verse. You heard that verse from little one growing up. But there's a lot more in there than what initially meets the eye if you take some time to digest it. "This is the day which the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." The title of the message is "The Day God Made and the Choice to Rejoice." I'm going to start out with a story. About a little over 10 years ago, I ran into a man called Jack. Now, some of you have heard this story before. But this man called Jack, he was in his upper 80s. And I was purchasing an aircraft from him with a partner. And I called Jack about this aircraft. We were interested in it, and I called him about it. And as we began to talk to Jack on the phone, something unique came out about Jack. You know how when you're calling somebody on the phone, you say, "Hello, what do you say? How are you, right? How are you doing?" Who says that? Anybody say that here on the phone? A few people do. I thought a lot more people did. Anyway, you generally call up and you say, "Hey, how are you doing?" Right? You call somebody on the phone, "Hello, how are you?" Everybody, what's the common answer? "I'm fine," right? That's usually what people say. You know, we're just kind of used to it. I go into default. "How are you? I'm fine." Okay, now that's done. Let's go on to the next thing. With Jack, it was different. When I called Jack, I said, "Hello, how are you?" And the line goes dead silent. I was like, "Are you there?" I was just, and as soon as I, just when I was ready to say that point in time, I was ready to say, "Are you still there?" He says, "I am absolutely, positively fantastic." And I was like, "Okay, well, that's great. He just made my day. You know, I'm absolutely, okay." So I thought, well, that must be a one-off. Well, I called Jack several times throughout the course of this transaction. "How are you?" Pause. "I am absolutely, positively fantastic." And he just brought joy to your face. Like, he was just such a joy to talk to Jack. And I began to look forward to talking to Jack because I expected this now. And it was such an interesting, and then I met him in person, and Jack was, you know, upper 80s, and he'd have passed for 65, like you'd have never guessed he was that. I found out later he had lost, thank you, Titus, he had lost his wife just previously. He wasn't fantastic because his life was excellent. It was 2011, business environment was a little tough then. He was in the construction industry. He wasn't fantastic because business was good and his life was perfect. Jack told me, I asked him about this, "I am absolutely, positively fantastic" thing, and he told me, he says, "I decided a while ago that life is much better if I decide that I'm okay." And he said, "I look myself in the mirror every morning and I say, Jack, you are absolutely, positively fantastic. So no matter what I'm facing," he says, "I'm okay," right? Well, Jack chose joy despite the circumstances around him, and he brought joy to a lot of other people. Think about how you, as a Christian, should be choosing joy today. Jack was a challenge to me. I don't know what he was as far as Christianity. He was some sort of a Christian, but I don't know. He was not, you know, like me, you know. But what a challenge. And I thought joy and rejoicing is such an essential part of the everyday Christian experience. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 16 says, "Rejoice how often?" Anybody know the other word? Rejoice evermore. Thank you. Philippians 4, 4, "Rejoice in the Lord always." And again, I say rejoice. James 1, 2, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations." In other words, when tough things happen, right? Count it all joy. Romans 15, 13, "Now the God of hope fill you with joy and peace in believing that you may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Ghost." Galatians 5, 22, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy," right? So joy is to be part of the Christian experience. And too often in my life, I fail to have God's joy in my heart. I allow the things that are going on around me to get me down or to discourage me or to take away my joy, and I'm not reflecting the joy of the Lord. So I want to go through Psalms 118 here, and I want to pull out eight steps to joy in Psalms 118 that we can learn from this morning. And we're going to do a little bit of a view in Psalms here, and then we're going to go into a more practical section if we have time, hopefully. But eight steps to joy in Psalms 118. How can we get to the point where we say, this is the day the Lord has made, we will rejoice and be glad in it? What do we need to do, to, like the psalmist, to get to that point? Our first step here that I see is found in verse 1 to 4, and he's talking here about God, who God is. He said, God is good, God is merciful, his mercy endures forever. Let the house of Aaron say his mercy endures forever. Let now them that fear the Lord say his mercy endures forever. So step number one is to just recognize who God is. If we don't recognize who God is, we have no basis, no foundation on which to found our joy. Understanding and acknowledging God and who he is and his nature and his goodness is key to our joy. Number two, step number two, found in verse 5 and verse 6. I called upon the Lord in distress, and the Lord answered me and set me in a large place. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do unto me? And I put down under here, I would put those verses as claim God as our personal helper. Step two to joy is claiming God as our personal helper. Hebrews 13, 5 to 6 says, let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man shall do unto me. The Lord is my helper. We see David here claiming God as his personal helper. He's on my side. What can man do unto me? Step two to getting to a place of joy is to claim God as our personal helper. Step number three, verses 6 and 7. We already read this one here. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do unto me? The Lord taketh my part with them that help me. Therefore shall I see my desire upon them that hate me. And I put under this one is to resize your problem and partner up. So those of you who live in this area might have seen a billboard just south of Hamburg along Route 61. I'm not sure if it's still there or not, but it was there for about a year. And on this billboard was a little tiny kitten. Little cute. You know when the kittens are cute before they're cats? You all know what I'm talking about? Before they scratch and kick and bite and get arrogant? This is the stage that this little kitten was. You know, the really tiny little kitten was on this billboard. And under the kitten, it said some strange words. It said, fear nothing. Now, which of you children think that's good words for a tiny little kitten? Should a kitten fear anything? Is there things for a kitten to fear? What about a coyote or a fox or a hawk? A lot of things that a kitten should fear, right? A little kitten on this billboard says, fear nothing. That doesn't even make any sense that a kitten should fear nothing. But what I didn't tell you about is what was behind the kitten. There was something else on the billboard. And behind this kitten, in the picture, was a lion. Does that change the picture a little bit? The rest of the billboard said, fear nothing because of who's behind you. And of course, the law firm was saying, we're behind you, therefore fear nothing. But doesn't that change the picture? That little tiny kitten is suddenly no longer afraid. Will a coyote approach a kitten with a lion right behind it? See, that fear's gone. Like, that, there's no need for that fear anymore. Resize and partner up. Fear nothing because of who's behind you. The presence of the lion resizes all the fearful thing that kitten faces. Dogs, coyotes, and foxes, they all become irrelevant. They're not even going to attempt to come near that kitten. So my question for you is your partnership with God close enough that you can resize your problems? Where do you keep them? A couple hundred yards away. You kind of have them out there as a concept. That lion wouldn't do a lot of good if he was 300 yards away from the kitten, right? It's in that closeness of the relationship that those problems get resized, right? Resize your problems and partner up. Number three, for joy. You know, we think about David. He was a resizer. Wasn't David a resizer? You all think of David's life. One of the first things he resized in life was the bear that came at him, right? All of a sudden, that bear that was coming to attack his sheep, he resized that, and he said, God gave me the lion and the bear, those two, the things there that came to attack his sheep. And then how about when he faced Goliath? Most people saw a 9-foot-tall guy who had a beam that, you know, would have scared anybody, right? If I was, like, bigger than, you know, this here, and that's what most people saw. But when David saw Goliath, he didn't see a giant. Why? Because he got resized. That giant got scaled right down to his proper place because David was a resizer. Resizing our problems and partnering with God are key to moving from fear to joy. And the alternative to being a resizer, we have an alternative. The alternative to that is to become a grasshopper man.
That's right.
If we are not a resizer, we will be a grasshopper man.
Absolutely.
I'd like to read to you from Numbers 13, verse 33. This was after the 12 spies were sent out, and they came back. And they were giving their report to Moses. And it says, and there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, who came of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. And so were we in their sight. We saw ourselves as grasshoppers, and they saw us as grasshoppers too. And then I'd like you to notice something else. Think about what we're talking about here, the joy of the Lord, and how to experience God's joy in our heart. Think of the mental state of the people after this report. Does anybody know what happened? What does the Bible say happened after they gave this report? Anybody knows? I didn't know it. They were fearful. I'm sure they were fearful. But there's something unique that they did. The whole congregation.
Melted?
Huh?
The hearts of the
melted. Yeah, it doesn't. I don't know if it specifically says that, but it's something that says very unique. Yes, they started crying. And they didn't just cry a little bit. It says the congregation of the lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. The entire night is what it seems like everybody was up all night, because it was the next day that Joshua and Caleb came and said, whoa!
Yes, that's right.
It seemed like they were weeping all night. Now remember, we're talking here about joy and the choice to rejoice and the role that resizing our problems plays in rejoicing. Right? Okay, then come along. So these were the grasshopper men. That was their report. They're giants. The resizer men come along, Joshua and Caleb. And they were with them that searched out the land. They saw these big men. There was no question about the big men being there. There were big men there. And they rent their clothes, and they spoke unto the company of the children of Israel, saying, the land which we pass through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. Only rebel ye not against the Lord, neither fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not. So two men looked at the same size of guys, these big giants, and saw them very differently. And the only difference between the resizers and the grasshoppers was how close they were to God. So I have a practical challenge for you. As I studied into this, I did something. I put my smartphone to good use, and I put a little reminder to come up every morning and say, will I be a resizer man today, or will I be a grasshopper man? Because, you know, we can talk about this now, but if it doesn't impact us on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, it didn't do a lot of good. So I challenge you to consider that. Will I be a resizer man or a grasshopper man? Will I walk close enough with God to resize my problems, or will I keep him a few hundred yards away? 8 steps to joy. Recognize who God is. Claim him as our personal helper. Resize and partner up with God. Point number 4. Go to verse 8 and 9. You're with me in Psalms chapter 118, verse 8 and 9. Said, it is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. And I summarized those two verses as saying, reject the world's false promises for happiness. You know, Satan is a swindler. He always has an alternative to God's plan that looks great but doesn't work. He always has an alternative to God's plan that looks great but doesn't work. Maybe you ever get swindled by a gadget that promised something and didn't deliver? You can raise your hand. I mean, I have. Like, I was out at a show one time, walking all day long, walking along. And when you're at a show walking, what tends to happen? Especially if you're not doing this every day, your legs get tired, your back gets tired and sore, at least mine does. And this booth I walked past had big signs up, back pain. We'll end your back pain. Ooh, talk about marketing at the right time when somebody's in need. My back is in severe pain. My legs are hurting. And this promises that they'll deliver me from this back pain and these sore legs. And I'm interested. And it did help the guys out there out of the booth. You know how they are. They're out there. And you come on in. Come on. Let me just show you. And, okay, so I go in and I listen to his spiel. And he tells me this is going to solve your problems. And he comes up with all kind of scientific sounding, explanations as to why this works. It's a little shoe insert, by the way. That's supposed to tilt you different and everything gets better, right? And I'm skeptical by nature, those of you who know me. This piece was like $350 for this two inserts. And that made me double skeptical. I even looked at him and I said, this thing isn't worth $20. I said, it wouldn't cost you $5 to make it. I told the guy that. And he kept on promising me things. Promise me, this is going to solve your problems. Do you know that I fell for that? I can't believe it either. I fell for that lie, that swindle. I got swindled. I put those things in my shoes and I thought everything was going to get better, and guess what? Nothing changed. I got swindled. Satan is a swindler who always has a false promise for something that says something they'll work, but they don't. What are some practical examples of that? You think of Satan's false promises that's going to bring you joy. How about the lie that says, putting myself first? That's going to make me happy. If I do what I want. You ever seen that in this world? How about cutting negative people out of my life? That's a real popular one. I have people, if you're good, to be happy, you cut negative people out of your life.
Cancel.
Yeah, you cancel people. You cut them out, right? That's going to make me happy, because if I don't have anybody negative in my life, then I'm going to be happy. Well, the truth is, usually people who say that means they want to cut out people who tell them the truth. That's usually what that amounts to. How about if I get the right spouse, if I get more money, if I get a different job, that'll make me happy. Those are some of the swindles that Satan brings along to promise happiness. If we're going to find God's happiness, we have to reject the false promises for happiness. Number 5, verse 10 to 12. Remember, our goal here is to learn how to find God's joy and put it practically into our life every day. All nations compass me about, but in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. They compass me about. Yea, they compass me about, but in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. That's verse 11. It repeats itself there. They compass me about like bees. They are quenched as the fire of thorns, for in the name of the Lord, I will destroy them. And there's a lot more that he says in this chapter that talks about the will. It says, I will not fear. I shall see the desire of my enemy. I will destroy them. I will destroy them. I will destroy them. It's three different times in this chapter. I shall not die. I shall live. I shall declare. I will go into the gates of righteousness. I will praise the Lord. I will praise thee. I will rejoice. I will praise thee. I will exalt thee. That's all in this chapter. I will, I will, I will, I shall. Notice it's not God's going to go get them. He says, I will destroy them. It is us directly facing our fears, our difficulties, and our sorrows with the confidence of who our partner is. Aligning our will with God's reality is a step on the path to joy. I'd like you to listen to what David says as he's yelling to his resized giant that he's going to face. He's running across the valley with his sling, and he's saying, this is what he yelled to Goliath. He said, God's going to deliver you into my hands. And then he says, God's going to knock you down. No, he doesn't. He says, I will smite thee. I will take your head. I will destroy the entire Philistine army. Do you notice how he was aligning? He says, God is going to give you to me and I will destroy it. There's alignment between God's power and his provision and our will. Our will, because of our human nature, constantly gets out of sync with God's reality. We think we can't. We think it's too hard. The giant is too big. Realignment is essential to joy. Jack looked at himself in the mirror every morning, and he said, I am absolutely, positively fantastic, Jack. What if you as a believer look in the Word of God every morning and realign your reality with God's reality. That you may boldly say to the giant you face, God is much bigger than you, and I will take your head. I will take your head. Take time every morning to resize your problems and align your will with God's reality. Aligning our will is a step on the path to joy. Step number 6, this is found in verse 18 of Psalms 118. Go down to verse 18. It says, the Lord hath chastened me sore, but he hath not given me over unto death. The Lord has chastened me sore, but he hath not given me over unto death. Step number 6 that I've written down is accept God's chastening as his love and understand its value. Be tickled that he loves you so much.
Right.
It's not easy to do with chastening, is it? It's hard to see that sometimes as God's love. Accept God's chastening as his love and understand its value. Proverbs 3:12, for whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father the son in whom he delighteth. Job 5:17, isn't this particularly poignant coming from Job? Job 5:17, behold, happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty. Hebrews 12:6-8, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then ye are bastards and not sons. Recognizing and accepting God's love in the form of chastening is essential to experiencing joy. Accept God's chastening. Number 7. I love this one. This is probably my favorite. And again, it's from verse 24 here. This is the day which the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. Have you ever gotten up in the morning or going to bed at night, I should say? You go into bed at night and you're thinking back through the events of the day and you say to yourself, you know, I really shouldn't have got out of bed this morning. Ever happened to you? You know, you started out and you had a lot to do and you had to pedal and you're going to go. And the day just kind of went backwards and you ended up behind her. For all the work you did that day, you were behind. That ever happened to anybody? I've had a few days like that where I just like, you know what? I just should have stayed in bed this morning and not done anything. I'd have been better off. We all have those days, right? Embrace God's sovereignty in the events of your daily life. It's the day God made for you. God made this day. It didn't take him by surprise. He wasn't shocked by the events.
That's right.
It was the day he made. And he approved for us to walk through. I'd like to take you to Job just a little bit. Job is, we're jumping in here at a time after, remember how all the messengers came to Job and said, your flocks got killed, your camels got killed, your asses and your oxen, everything. Remember how they did that? And Satan had at times to have maximum emotional impact. As soon as the one got done speaking, the next one would come with the bad news. He knew what he was doing. Overwhelm him. Overwhelm his emotions, right? Well, this is the last messenger we're going to jump in here, and I'm going to read to you from Job 1, verse 19. The messenger comes up, Job! He doesn't know about the others, probably. He says, behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, Job's children, and they are dead, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down on the ground and worshipped. And worshipped. And said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. Embrace God's sovereignty in the events of your daily life. It's the day God made for you. Lastly, the last point here that I have from Psalms 118 is in verse 28. Thou art my God, and I will praise thee. Thou art my God, I will exalt thee. I will praise thee. I will exalt thee. Make the choice to worship. We saw that there with Job. In this last verse, Job 1:20, it says, then Job arose and rent his mantle, shaved his head, and fell down on the ground and worshipped. Step number 8 to joy, and the last one here from this chapter, is to make the choice to worship. I'd like you to think a little bit with me how history might be different. What are other ways that that verse in Job might read? So after all this stuff that happened, how might it read if it happened to me? Would it read like that? Then Job arose and rent his mantles and shaved his head and threw a temper tantrum. Right. Ever seen that? Yeah. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and pouted like Ahab. Remember the story of Ahab when he couldn't get his vineyard? What did it say he do? I thought that's such a childish thing. He goes up to his bedroom. Goes up to his bedroom, lays in his bed, turns his face to the wall and pouts. Yeah. A grown man. Woo! Unbelievable. He needed a good licking. But people do that today. Mm-hmm. We get this kind of stuff. Pouted like Ahab. Mm-hmm. Then Job arose, rent his mantle, shaved his head, and went for counseling. Not knocking counseling, but it's not what Job did. Then Job arose and rent his mantle, shaved his head, and went to the doctor for an antidepressant. I mean, I'm not knocking it. We have things that I'm not saying that's never appropriate. I'm just saying Job worshipped. And it had an impact on his joy. If we want to experience genuine joy, we have to make the choice to worship. So I want to move a little bit into the practical section. Practical joy today. How can I build joy into my life each day? Because we need to be able to take these principles and we need to be able to apply them to 2023 and put them into to shoe leather every day. So how do we put these principles into our life? And so I just picked a few things out here to share. Remember we talked about Satan's deceptions and the things that he offers in place of God's joy. And when we accept those lies into our heart, the same thing happens to us that happened to me with those shoe inserts. We think we're going to get something and we don't get anything, right? And we don't actually begin to seek true answers, right? Instead, we accept those shoe inserts and we look to them as our solution. So that's why it's important that we reject the world solution, because if we accept the world solution for happiness and we let those lies into our heart, we will deny ourselves the ability to understand how to find true joy every day. So we have to recognize and reject the world's false promises for happiness. So I'm going to put some detail into that. What are some of the world's false promises, some of the most prevalent ones? We already mentioned the one about the me-first happiness. Putting myself first will make me happy. My time, my money, my life, my talents comes from the world revolving around me. That is a lie from Satan. What does Jesus say? John 12, verse 24 says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall to the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it. He that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal." So joy from God comes from giving our heart and our life to others, not from putting myself first. And that is a lie from Satan. If you think that you're going to get happiness by putting yourself first, it's a lie. It won't work. How about this one? How about acquisition happiness? Anybody ever see that? It comes closer to home than we like to realize sometimes. Getting something that I don't have will bring happiness. You know, a new truck. Surely if I have a new truck, I'll be happy. How long will that last? The problems with that is they always grow old. You know, a new truck will make me happy, but then the truck gets old. How about a new purse? I've seen some ladies get pretty excited about a new purse. It's not wrong. I'm not saying, you know, things like that can be joyful. They can bring us joy, but they are not your source for happiness. And if they are, it's going to fade as soon as the purse gets old. Okay? Goes out of style. How about a spouse? People think, if I get married to the right person, surely I'll be happy. That is such a bunch of... Well, I won't say anything more. It's not true. Right? It's not true. A new spouse doesn't make you happy. Spouse is going to sometimes do something disappointing. Right? If you're depending on your spouse to make you happy, you will be a miserable person. A financial windfall. Surely if I get some kind of a financial windfall, that can make it happen. But then it runs out. Or somebody else gets more. acquisition happiness. Joy that is not acquired by a purposeful choice to count your blessings will quickly fade. Okay? These are the lies from Satan. He that loveth silver, Ecclesiastes 5:10, he that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Coming from somebody who really knew what he was talking about in that. Acquisition happiness. Me first happiness. They're lies from Satan. How about this one? Comparison happiness. Okay, so these are sort of related, but there's this little twist on it where the thing that I get my happiness from is because I have something that somebody else doesn't have. You understand what I'm saying? Nobody understands that? I think you do. Right? Comparison happiness. A better truck. Not the fact the truck is new, just the fact that mine is a 1989 where the other guy has a 1988. You understand? Okay, this goes to all scales. It doesn't, you know, like this is, right, comparison happiness. A better truck, a better house, a better airplane. The problem is that we always run into somebody else who has something better. I have seen guys. You go to airplane ramps, you see this at play. I just got an old 45-year-old airplane, right? And so I'm just kind of the bottom of the barrel. But you go to a ramp, and then they pull up in a sleek new Cirrus. But the problem is if your joy comes from that sleek new Cirrus and having something better than the puddle jumper that you had that's 40 years old, somebody pulls up beside you in a Honda Jet. And what a bummer. All of a sudden, that joy just fades out the window. And then if you get the Honda Jet, what happens? Then the Gulfstream 650 comes up beside you. And always, I see people on these cycles. It's almost laughable when you really think about it, because they think they're going to get joy by getting something better than the next guy. It's an endless hamster wheel. You'll never get there. Right. Never, ever get there. Comparison happiness. How about decorating? Let's bring this. Okay, I said I was going to be practical, so I'm going to be practical here, right? How about decorating? You know, some of you ladies love to decorate, and I'm glad you do. That's great. You know, your homes are beautiful, and that's a wonderful thing. You know, it brings a lot of joy, and it brings peace and just a lot of joy to you, and that's great. And that's right. There's nothing wrong with that. That's beautiful. But what about if it's trying to beat the latest Instagram post? Mm-hmm. How far away are you from losing that happiness? One post away. Right? And that happiness goes out the window because, ooh, I need that. Right? So if your joy is coming from the comparison of yourself to others, you're on an endless hamster wheel that will never, never, ever go away. You know, if you think about comparison happiness, you don't have a choice but to think about the epicenter of comparison is found online. You know, there's social media is the epicenter of that. That is what inspires it and what drives it. It is what it's funded by, and it's its purpose. It's why it's successful. Do you ever think about it when you go on a Facebook and you look at somebody's profile, you'll see their name, and then just a little bit down to the left, the very first thing, one of the very most prominent things you see is going to be what? How many friends they have, right? They have 500 friends or 800 friends or 1,000 friends. Now, of all the details that would be important about a person, where would that fall in reality? Does it make him a better person?
No.
What should Facebook be, if you're thinking of a logical kind of thing, what would you, there's a billion things you would probably put beyond how many friends they have. Why does Facebook do that? It's because people are addicted to comparing themselves with others. And that number is there for the benefit of the account owner. Think about it. Why is every post list the number of thumbs up? You know, likes. You seen that? This post has so many likes, so many shares, so many comments. Why is that important? Does it make the comment better if it was, you know, like it's... It's really an irrelevant piece of information, but I submit to you, they are there so that people can experience the drug of comparing themselves with others. It is incompatible, That whole thing that drives it is incompatible with Christianity. It's incompatible with Christianity. John 5:44, how can ye believe which receive honor one of another and seek not the honor that cometh from God only? It's not my words. Second thing of social media that talks about this comparison happiness is, you know, subtle yet shameless comparison with others. You have the friends, comments, and likes. You have this subtle yet shameless comparison. Everyone is beautiful. Everyone is cute. Everyone is adorable. Relative to what? Others. Their houses are better than others. Their vacations are more fun. Their hair is prettier. Their teeth are whiter. Their diet is better. Their dogs are cuter. Their coffee shop they go to is cooler. And even the cream on their coffee is prettier. Any seen that? Yeah, that's right. That's a thing, by the way. It is incompatible with Christianity. 2 Corinthians 10:12, for we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves, but they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. Amen. That kind of social media use is incompatible with Christianity. Now, I don't want to say, you know, okay, is it possible to use social media in a proper way? Probably, yes. I think it is. It's an uphill battle, and it certainly needs to be used very differently than the world uses it. And I believe largely we do well here, but I'm just warning you, the thing that drives this is this whole comparison thing. And I think, no, I don't think, I know, it's in the data. This has depressed people. Do you realize? Look at the numbers. Just go Google sometime teen suicides from 2007 when social media became popular to today. And that tells you everything. The world's concerned about it. It is making people depressed. Why? Because of these principles. You cannot take Satan's lie and promise for happiness that comparing yourself to other people is going to bring you happiness. More likes, more friends, more better house. All those, that comparison doesn't bring you, it's an endless thing. I'm going to bring in here a little thing about, I think this comparison thing is so critical because comparison brings jealousy. I've seen so much trouble because people look around and compare themselves with others. The Bible says it's not wise. And I think it starts very young. You know, it's born into a child. Those of you who have several children know what I'm talking about. When I say, you know, just imagine this scenario. You're pouring out a bunch of chocolate milk cups for your children. They're all sitting in a row in the bar in front of you, and you're pouring out chocolate milk. Good, delicious chocolate milk. They just came in. They're excited about this. And you put the chocolate milk into these cups. And they should be delighted to have chocolate milk. But what do they tend to do? His is fuller than mine. Have you ever heard that? Be honest. Yeah, you've heard that. If you have children, you've heard that. His is fuller than mine. You see this comparison thing is born into you, and it, the world it built on that and promises happiness. If my chocolate cup is just a little fuller than his, I'll be happy. You know, and so here's a warning for us as parents. Instead of rejoicing in that chocolate milk cup that they have, that they didn't have before, they're comparing it. And they lose the joy of their chocolate milk because of that comparison. It's gone and stolen from them because of that comparison. So, what should we do as parents? Okay? If we are the parent who adds chocolate milk to that cup to try to make their life fair relative to others, we are inadvertently reinforcing the lie from Satan of comparison happiness. And we will produce miserable, unhappy, self-centered children. We will teach them that. I've seen it. You've probably seen it. Experienced it in our home. So some, you know, if you don't catch on to this early on as a parent, you'll catch on to it later on to some extent because of necessity. Right? But what's really sad is what happens to those children unchecked in 15 years. They become adults. You ever seen an adult who expects life to hand out level cups of chocolate milk? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who destroy marriages by comparing their spouses to others, mm-hmm. overlooking their good points and focusing on the shortcomings. They're the ones who constantly feel wronged by everyone and everything. Their entitlement, jealousy, bitterness destroys relationship after relationship. Mm-hmm. They are the parents who will train their children so that they look good relative to other parents. They are the social media addicts who endlessly search for fake friends and who will tell them they're the most splendid thing that ever walked the face of the planet. They are blind to critical truths about themselves because their fragile comparison mindset simply can't handle it. They have to believe certain things about themselves. They are insecure churchgoers who will gossip and degrade others to make themselves feel better. They are complainers who are far quicker to grumble about everything around them than they are to put their shoulder to the wheel and work to make a real difference. These are the children that grow up expecting level chocolate cups from life. Doesn't happen, folks. Life is not fair. The sooner we learn that, the better. You know, and I said, so what do we do to help our children with that? You know, if your child compares their chocolate milk level to others, maybe the best thing you could do is take that chocolate milk they have and pour it down the drain. Because in life, if we don't choose to enjoy the blessings that we have, we will lose them, the joy of the blessing we do have. If we compare our blessing to others and we don't choose to appreciate and enjoy the blessing God gives us, we will lose the joy of that blessing. It will be stolen from us. So what better thing could you do than to simulate life for your child and say, you know, you don't appreciate that? Think about it, maybe. And that leads me to practical principle number two. So we talked about identifying and rejecting the world's solution to happiness, the lies that he says that, you know, if you are me first, you're gonna be happy. If you get things, you're gonna be happy. If you compare yourself to others and you're better than get something better than others, you're gonna be happy. Those are all lies. We talked about that, and now we're gonna talk about loving the blessings that we do have. Count them one by one. We have that song that goes, you know. Count them one by one, right? Yep, one upon life's billows. Talks about counting your blessings one by one. Literally, truly joyful people are joyful because they've made the choice to be joyful and content with what God has given them. Husbands, love your wife. Delight in who she is individually and create an environment that helps her grow. Everybody wants a virtuous wife, right? I hear that all the time. Virtuous women are just born, aren't they? They pop out and boom, they're virtuous. I get so annoyed when I hear a man say, oh, my wife should be more virtuous. She should be better. What are you doing about it? Virtuous women are put in an environment that grow into that, either by their father or by their husband. There was some environment that created soil that that virtue could grow in. Love your wife. Give her that environment. Love the blessings that you have. Virtuous women don't magically appear. They become that because a parent or husband created an environment where she could grow. Wives, delight in your husbands. Delight in them. Highlight and enjoy his good points. Be the woman who helps him grow into a better person by creating an environment of gratitude. This is a step to joy. Young people, take delight in this stage of your life. There's a lot of blessings that you experience. Enjoy it. Enjoy the blessing that it offers. My grandfather used to say some words that I think are truer than ever. He would say, contentment is not having what you want, but wanting what you have. Contentment is not having what you want, but wanting what you have. Love the blessings that you have. The third principle that I'd like to bring out, practical, is to know what drains and fills your tank. These are just, again, very practical principles trying to bring out. Know what fills and drains your tank. Joy in and joy out. You know, think of a tank. If you think about a tank in life, you got this tank here, and you're pouring out to people. There are drains in your life, right? For men, it's often, I mean, it can be work. Work is probably a drain. It's something that we can get stressful and can get, you know, maybe finances can be a drain. Maybe you know, who knows what? You know what the drains are in your life. Maybe areas of service are a drain. You know, there's certain drains that we have in our lives and that are just going to constantly take something out of us. If we do not fill that tank back up, that tank will get empty. And pretty soon, we don't have a lot left to give. And you might say, well, that sounds strange. Prove it to me.
Okay, so Jesus understood the tank principle, and I'd like to just go through, we're going to go through a couple of different scenarios to see how Jesus put things into his tank. He filled his tank. You would think he wouldn't have needed to as a son of God, but he was in human flesh, and he had to fill his tank, and he did it. Until I did this study, I didn't put this all together. Okay, so we have a couple, I'm going to just bring out a couple of places in Jesus' life here. So after he got the news of John the Baptist being killed by Herod, remember when that happened, when John the Baptist's head was taken off by Herod, and the disciples came and told Jesus about it. And right after that, Jesus said, when he heard of it, of this event with Herod, now think of how he was, you know, think of the emotion that was involved in that, with John the Baptist being his forerunner and you know, close there and whatever. When Jesus heard of it, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. Now, this was a tough emotional time. This was difficult when Jesus heard this news. And it says, when he heard of it, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. Now, go on. Just keep that in your mind. So he's on this ship going to away to be alone, right? A desert place apart on a ship. And when the people heard thereof, they followed him on foot out of the cities. And Jesus went forth and saw the great multitude, when he's on the other side of the lake, and moved with compassion toward them. And he healed their sick. So he began to minister again. Okay? So you follow me so far. So he has this emotional trauma, this emotional news. Very difficult. He moves on, and he gets in a ship right after hearing that, and he's going to go be alone. The people come around the sea, and they come over there, and oh, here they are. And he serves them once again. Okay? It'll be important a little later. Okay, then straightway, Jesus, and after he taught them and fed that multitude, and they were fed now, and they were served, and they were, you know, ready to go home. After that multitude was fed, it says, straightway, Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and to go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when evening was come, he was there alone. So finally, he got to his time alone in the mountain that he was headed for, right? Refilling his tank, recharging his tank. Okay? And keep in mind that he headed there, served, and then refilled his tank. Again, that's going to be important in a little bit. All right. Now, another time, we're going to go to a different scenario now. Jesus had sent the disciples out to minister, and they came back to him, and it says, the apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus, and he told him all things, both what they had, and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. So they're coming back to Jesus and saying, this is a report of our trip, what we were doing, where we were working, what was happening. And they told him all about that. And he says unto them, his disciples, come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. And they departed into a desert place by ship, privately. Why did Jesus choose to travel by ship instead of walking? Obviously, he could have walked there because all the multitude walked around the lake to get there. Think about this. Why did Jesus choose to travel by ship instead of walking? He could have walked there. They could have stayed in the city. Could have found a little room in a corner somewhere. Remember when the storm was raging on the way back? Where was Jesus found? Down in the hold of the ship. What? Sleeping, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think the reason he took a ship is because he really liked the ocean. I think there was something there that he just loved, the peace that the ocean represented. And I think he took the ship on purpose when he could have walked, and it would have saved money, presumably. I'm reading into it there a little bit. But I think Jesus loved the sea. I think it filled his tank. Okay? And this, there's multiple times when he did that thing by ship, and they went away privately. You know, I think the sea represented something to Jesus. I think he loved the peace there. Jesus took time to enjoy nature. I think that also filled his tank. He went to the desert. He went to the mountain. He didn't need to do that. He could have found another way to get away. I think he loved gazing at the stars. Maybe they reminded him the stories of the wise men when he was little and how they were guided by the star. Whatever the case, he definitely took time to refill and to refresh, and he led his disciples in doing that. And I think that's a lesson for us today. Now, I'd like to say, if you identify the drains in your life, Jesus knew clearly where his areas of service were. Remember how I said he went across the first time, the multitude ran around and met him there? And he was going to go on vacation, let's put it that way in our terms. And what did he do? He served them. Why? Because he truly understood his mission. He clearly understood why he was there, what his drains were, what his areas of service were. You get what I'm saying here with areas of service, right? He had clearly understood that. So he had identified those, and those took a high priority. If we don't identify our areas of service, we're going to find it hard to do them joyfully and purposefully, as they'll simply feel like annoyances to us, right? If you don't view your little children as a purposeful mission field, the drains of endless dirty diapers and constant needs will become a despised annoyance if you don't see it as a mission. You'll end up doing them grudgingly and without full effectiveness. So if you don't identify your drains, you're going to find it hard to fulfill your calling purposefully and joyfully. If you don't identify your drains, you're also going to take on too many drains until you do nothing effectively. Right? That's also a danger. So that's why you need to know, these are the areas of service that God has called me to. My marriage, my home, my church, whatever the areas of service that God has called you to. It's important for joy that you identify the areas of drains that God has called you to. So I'd like you to just take a moment and think to yourself in your mind, what are the areas of service that God has called me to? What are a few areas of service that God has called me to? Think about that for just a minute. So once you've identified some of that, the other thing that Jesus identified was what filled his tank. And I'd like to just ask you, Jesus would have said to the disciples, you know, what fills your tank? Maybe it's boating like it was for Jesus. Maybe it's getting alone in the mountains. Maybe it's coffee in the morning. Maybe it's quiet time, a nap, a date, sewing, painting, quilting, cabin time, going to the beach, travel, a quiet evening at home, a good book, time with friends, hunting, fishing, you know, going to the shop and fixing things. Some people get joy out of fixing things. Like, yeah, believe it or not. what fills your tank? Okay? So identify what drains and what fills, and then put appropriate time in there and appropriate times to refill your tank. This is a pattern that Jesus established, and I think it's important for us to establish that for joy. And then the second thing I'd like to say is bring God along. Turbocharge your recreation by basking in God's presence. Jesus went into the mountain to rest, recharge, and reconnect and commune with God. You know, hunting is a wonderful excuse to spend time alone and quiet with God. There's a lot of times like that. Quilting or sewing is a splendid time to rejoice in your blessings and just bring God along to that time, because that turbocharges the input that you have in your life. So don't go and do these things and say, well, I'm going to just party. That's not what this is. This is a time of refreshment and a time of refilling and bringing God into that. So in review of Psalms 118, how can we rejoice in the day God made? This is the day the Lord hath made. We will rejoice. Recognize who God is. Claim him as your personal helper. Be a resizer, not a grasshopper. Man, be a resizer, not a grasshopper. Reject the world's false promises for happiness, because if you let those in, you can't have God's way in there. They're not compatible. Align your will. Align your will with God. Think of Jack. I am absolutely, positively fantastic. And we have another man here at this congregation who you call him up and say, how are you doing? He says, thank God for whatever day it is, right? That's something I've learned to enjoy when I talk to John, because it's a blessing, right? And it's true, and it's a challenge, right? Align your will with God's reality. Delight in God's chastening. Number six, embrace each day. This is the day God made for me. This is not a shock to him. He wasn't surprised by these events that happened. He didn't say, ooh, didn't see that one coming. Make the choice to worship, like Job fell down on the ground and worshiped. God's blessing to each of you.